It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll get an overview of last night's state election results with WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson.
First, we're coming up on charitable giving season with the holidays right around the corner. There are lots of options out there for volunteering and charity donations, but which ones have the most impact? How can we really make a difference with limited resources?
Our guest tackled these questions in her latest book and created a guide for giving. She is Cheryl Wu Dunn. She's the co-author with her husband, Nicholas Kristof, of A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. She's a senior managing director at Mid-Market Securities and also president at Full Sky Capital, which advises entrepreneurs. Cheryl, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, wonderful to be here. Thanks, Rob.
So when we look, most of us have sub-Bill Gates amounts of money at our disposal, and we look at the problems around the world. They're big. They're complex. They seem hard to solve. How do we keep from being discouraged from trying to give and trying to make a difference?
Oh, there's so many ways that you can make a difference. And what we do is we take you on a journey through the different ways that you can do things, what people have accomplished. Take Shoshana Klein, for instance. She was born with clubfoot. And, of course, in the U.S., when you're born with clubfoot, the doctor immediately does a series of surgeries and you're cured. And you often don't even know that you had it. But, of course, she remembers the pictures. She's seen the pictures and she knows she had it. And so she got this mailing at home that appealed to her for some help to cure clubfoot for kids in Niger. And so we followed the money. She wrote a check out. We followed the money. And there was a little girl named Rashida who had clubfoot in 2 feet, which isn't so uncommon there. And she would have spent her life as a beggar, never would have gone to school, never would have gotten a job or become a mom. In a series of operations, Shoshana Klein's money did help Rashida have a cure. She was cured of clubfoot. Now, Shoshana didn't solve the global problem for clubfoot. She didn't even solve the national problem in Niger of clubfoot. But she transformed the life of Rashida. And that's how you make a difference. You can transform people's lives. You can actually lift their entire family from poverty and alter the life path of a young child who probably would otherwise be faced with a life of poverty.
Now, that story and the other ones you tell, it raised so many interesting questions. I want to start with, you know, in that example, you talked about a person who took her personal experience and her personal interest, and that's what connected her with this type of charitable giving. Does that tend, following our gut like that, tend to point us in a good direction, or should we be hitting the books, doing the research, trying to figure out where our money makes the most difference?
It's a combination of both. So what we've done in A Path Appears is actually we focused on the evidence-based strategies that really have shown to work, focusing on early childhood education, for instance. Even Head Start. Head Start has proven to be extremely valuable. Some of the cognitive or academic gains may be lost in the ensuing 2 or 3 years after the Head Start program. But they have looked at they've actually followed some of the Head Start classes 20 years, and they've seen what happens to those individuals. And those individuals tend to be much more well-off. They have stable families. They have a stable job compared to even siblings in the same family who didn't go through Head Start. So there's a lot of rigorous research that shows that programs like that do work. You don't have to spend your lifetime researching these kinds of programs. I mean, we've written a lot about them. But I think it's best when there's a connection that is made to your own background coupled with some of the research that you might want to do looking into the problem a little bit more deeply.
We're bombarded with requests for money on social media, on TV, as we walk down the street sometimes. How do we assess who's asking us for money or who's out there that we just don't have a connection with yet? How do we decide which one is right for us, which one's going to make a difference?
Yes, sometimes people raise a lot of money because they ask. So it is true that when you walk down the street, you might encounter what we call chuggers. These are people who are charity muggers. It's kind of a disdainful name, and not all of them are that bad. But I think that often in those cases, the people who are canvassing, they will take 50%, 60% of the money. So a smaller portion of your money goes to the actual person in need. But, you know, still, many charities rely on that because they don't have the network. They don't have the number of people to go out on the streets to canvass for money. And as long as you're aware of that, then that's fine if it's a cause that you care about, if it's a particular end game that you really want to play a role in. But if you do your own research, there are some sites, GiveWell, for instance, that actually evaluates charities based on the outcomes that they produce, how much bang for your money you get when you donate to a particular cause. And they actually rank some of these causes.
Now, you write, one interesting bit I thought was you talk about the most boring aid in the world. And this was a case where a group combating blindness was trying to help substitute one kind of sweet potato for another. How important is that to have those small but measurable efforts out there to try to make a simple but significant change?
Oh, it's so important. I know it does sound really boring. And sort of Helen Keller is kind of the flagship for that kind of boring aid, but they do so much amazing work. Micronutrients are really important. 40% of children in Bangladesh are malnourished. So you need to get those nutrients to those kids at an early age because beyond that, once they grow old, if they've been malnourished when they were young, they will never recover some of the problems that they incur. Your brain actually doesn't develop fully if you don't have all the right micronutrients. And physically, of course, you don't grow as tall. Your growth sometimes is stunted. So it's really important. But who cares about, micronutrients? Or deworming, for instance. That's another example. How many people want to say, I gave a deworming pill to a kid in Nigeria? It's not that sexy, but it is extremely effective.
We'll talk more about the deworming because there were measurements of the impact that had apart from the immediate health benefits. Can you expand on that a little?
Oh, absolutely. So, for instance, we often think, well, how do we keep kids in school? Because of course, kids in school is really important, keeping them there. You think, well, you have to build schools first. You have to pay for the teachers. You have to pay for the textbooks. Yes, you need all the hardware and you need the software. But often, one of the most effective ways to keep kids in school is to deworm them. And what I mean is that when kids here in the U.S., we don't get worms or intestinal worms, but in many parts of Africa, you get intestinal worms. You get diarrhea, unfortunately. Your stomach feels terrible. You can't concentrate in school. When you can't concentrate, then you fall behind in work, and then you tend to drop out. If you actually take a deworming pill every year, you're less likely to fall out. You're more likely actually to stay in school. And so to keep that marginal kid in school, do you pay for a program of deworming pills for a year? It's $3.50. For each kid, it's 50 cents. So if you actually can want to keep that extra kid in school, $3.50 will go a long way.
So circling back to the point we started with, a donation of $3.50 buys a year of school for a kid, in effect.
In effect, because it's really that marginal kid. So you really have to – you can never figure out which kid you'll keep in school. So if you, fund basically five, six kids, those kids will – that last marginal kid will not fall out of school. So – but, if you just want to fund one kid, that's fine, too. 50 cents.
So how do I say I'm somebody, I've got some cash, I want to donate it somewhere. How do I find this kind of non-sexy cause, this simple but effective solution to put my money into?
Well, Deworm the World. And that's an organization that you can actually go to. We also have in the back of A Path Appears, we have pages of organizations, some which we actually write about in A Path Appears, but others that we actually have seen some of their work. And it's a starting point for you to figure out, which areas that am I interested in? It's really a starting point because we want you to learn a little bit about kind of the cause that you find interesting, and also to compare causes. Maybe you get a group of friends together and you all choose a few areas that you might want to go deeper into, and then you might all pool some money and donate together, or you might volunteer. You might all together decide to go into advocacy. There are many ways that you can actually play a role.
We're talking to author Cheryl Wudun about her new book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, talking about how to donate our money, maybe our time, most effectively to make a difference in the world, to improve lives of others and change the planet.
What do you do to help others? Do you volunteer or regularly donate? Do you feel like you're making a difference? And how do you choose which charitable organizations to participate in? Do you have any questions about how to give most effectively? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our discussion now with Cheryl Wu-Dunn about her new book on how to give effectively. It's called A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. How do you decide where to give money or to volunteer? What do you donate to? What do you contribute to? How do you know that you're making an impact? And what do you get out of giving? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go now to our callers. We've got Aiden on the line in Barron County. Aiden, hi.
Call 800-642-1234.
I just wanted to... Yeah.
Go ahead, Aiden.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that as an original African-American that came from Kenya, I like to just say that no matter how much it is, even 1 cent helps. Like, the money in America is worth so much money in Africa. So, like, no matter what, like, you don't have to be rich to help poor people. Like, as, like, Barron County right now, the money that I sent home back to Africa, like, it helps a lot of kids. I have an orphan kid that I treat, like, I'm only 70 years old. But to help a kid have a brighter future, like, makes me, like, a real good feel about myself.
Aiden, thank you so much. A couple points I want to get into there, Cheryl.
Yes.
First of all, the leverage, a little bit of money by American standards could actually be quite a fair amount elsewhere.
Absolutely. That's why places like GiveWell suggest that you focus overseas. And a lot of the organizations that we have also are overseas because your dollar just goes farther. You can raise a kid. You can do a lot more with the money overseas. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be also looking at opportunities here at home. There are so many ways that we can help here at home that we tend to overlook them because we assume that everyone in America is doing just fine. Well, they're not. There are a lot of people who are still below the poverty line. There's a widening gap between the rich and the poor. And what we need to focus on here at home is spreading opportunity. So it may not necessarily be just dollars, but also advocacy, trying to push through and let our politicians know that we care about education because that is the way to spread opportunity. Education really is a ladder out of poverty.
And you make the argument in your book that philanthropy doesn't replace policy. It goes alongside it.
Oh, absolutely. Look, we wouldn't build roads with volunteers in the same way we wouldn't want to raise human beings here just with volunteers. We really do need everybody working together. Government policy is very important, but that does not mean that the individual can't play a role. And so what we're trying to argue is that the individual can play an enormous role in the same way that you go out and vote. Your vote is one vote, but if everybody votes, then you have a movement. And in the same way, if you as one person do, and hopefully if everyone else does the same thing, plays a role in trying to, you know, whether it's donating or volunteering or getting engaged in civil society, then we can bring about change.
Aiden, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Derek in La Crosse. Derek, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling. I did, my wife had done 2 years in AmeriCorps, and I got into it through her and did 2 years myself. What I really enjoyed about that was it's very local, community oriented. You know, it's basically a domestic version of the Peace Corps. But what happens is, you know, you're assigned, everybody's assigned to a certain place, but on a general scale, on a weekly scale, besides that, I was a tutor at a local middle school, and I helped educated youth learn construction skills was my other job. But with the the whole dynamic, you know, on a weekly basis, we got to go and do general community service as well as our own assigned missions. It was very...
Derek, thanks a lot. I want to get Cheryl in on this. Opportunities to not, in this case, not donate money, but to get involved directly with education, community service projects. It doesn't have to be giving money, Cheryl.
Absolutely. As I said before, advocacy is one way, volunteering is another. I think it's important to realize that, I mean, I really admire you having gone into the AmeriCorps. That's a wonderful program. I really like it. But also, going forward, people don't have to drop everything and go into the AmeriCorps or go into the Peace Corps. In fact, what they can do is fold some of their volunteer work or giving or advocacy work into their daily lives. So it doesn't have to overtake their lives, but it actually can be part of their life. And when it is part of your life, it does lift lift your spirits. In fact, we talk a lot about the benefits of giving.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. You actually get into some of the neuroscience. Why do we as humans enjoy, benefit from giving?
It's very interesting. We actually derive pleasure from giving. Neuroscientists have actually scanned the brain to see what happens when you give. And it turns out that giving stimulates a certain part of the brain that is the pleasure center, the same pleasure center that is stimulated when you eat candy or ice cream or when you flirt or fall in love or have sex. So that means that you are enjoying giving. And some people, in fact, half of the research subjects that they analyzed had more intense pleasure when they gave than when they actually received. So just as the Bible says, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Now, modern neuroscience has proved that.
So you're telling the story of the benefits to us of giving. Also, it seems like you know, it's easy to focus on the problems in the world. Do we not tell the success stories of giving and philanthropy enough?
I think that is true. So we, in A Path Forward, we really do talk a lot about success stories, but also the challenges. I think you have to partner success with challenge because you have to give people an understanding of what's at the other end and what are the benefits at the other end. I think that just all doom just is kind of dispiriting. And we also know that psychologically, people are going to be less prone to help if they feel that they're not going to be able to make a difference. And being able to make a difference is extremely important. We did some research. We looked at some research that analyzes what it takes for people to feel that they are making a difference.
We just have a couple minutes left, and you close the book with six steps we can take in the next 6 minutes. So if somebody says, okay, after we get off the air, I want to do one or two little things to start changing the world. Can you share a couple of those?
Well, one is get together with a group of friends and form a giving club, or a, you know, you can even start with your book club and then choose a place that you want to donate your time or your money or whatever, and discuss the topic that you're all interested in. I think when you do it with friends, it's much more social and it's much more pleasurable. And that's one of the most fun things that you can do.
Do you think this is catching on? Are we getting more charitable, more generous, more connected in the United States? Or are you worried that we're headed in the wrong direction?
Well, no. The numbers show that we are actually more generous. In fact, our charitable donations as a country in the U.S. are going up. Individuals make up about two-thirds of all the charitable giving, so we are very generous. We're not the most generous in the world. Australia takes that award, but we are way up there.
So leave us with a few thoughts on inspiration as we go into the holiday season for thinking of ourselves as connected philanthropists in the world.
I think it's first of all, it's a wonderful thing. You derive a lot of pleasure from it, and as we discuss in A Path of Bridge, you can actually even become healthier. It does help with health and with longer life span, and it's just a lot of fun if you do it with some friends.
All right, Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Cheryl Wudun. She's co-author with her husband, Nicholas Kristof, of the book we've been talking about. It's called A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. She's a senior managing director at Mid-Market Securities, and she's also president at Full Sky Capital, which advises entrepreneurs.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer. This week, we have a lot to talk about. The Republicans have swept the U.S. Senate, and they're crafting their new agenda.
First, though, we're going to focus in on Wisconsin. Last night, the state's Republican Party saw a string of successes that will strengthen their control in the state. Governor Scott Walker kept his seat with a clearer victory than many polls projected. The attorney general race went to Republican Brad Schimmel, and Republicans held their ground in the state Senate.
Secretary of State Doug LaFollette was the only Democrat to win statewide office, keeping a seat he's held for four decades. Governor Scott Walker delivered an enthusiastic victory speech in West Allis last night, thanking God and criticizing the government in Washington.
WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson joins us now to give us an overview of Wisconsin's midterm election results. It's good to have you back, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So big wins for Republicans in Wisconsin last night. How big a win was this for the GOP, would you say, and for the conservative agenda?
I would say that it was pretty close to their wins in 2010, when we were saying, you know, that's a once-in-a-generation win for Republicans. And here they've come back, and Governor Walker had his third win in 4 years. You know, he's won now as a first-time candidate for statewide office. He's won a recall. He's now won re-election, and he won it, as you mentioned, by a wider margin than a lot of people were expecting. The legislature, even after 4 years of, having voters having a chance to look at their record, they gave the legislature larger Republican majorities in the Senate and in the Assembly, where it looks like Republicans may now have 63 seats in the Assembly, pending a couple potential recounts, and a margin of 19-14 in the Senate. So very big night for Republicans, very bad night for Democrats in Wisconsin. They really don't have much to point to. Their only winner statewide was Doug LaFollette for Secretary of State, who also withstood that wave year of 2010. But the bad news for Democrats is the Secretary of State has essentially no duties. So it's a win in name only.
Now, the governor's race was pegged as being incredibly close. The polls were neck and neck for most of the race. And still, this margin of victory last night for Scott Walker was almost 6 points. What do you make of that?
Well, I heard from a Democratic pollster a couple weeks before the election day. And Paul Maslin at the time was the only person I was hearing say, you know, don't be surprised if this thing is a lot wider of a margin either for Mary Burke or Scott Walker than everyone's predicting, because really over the past 10 years, we haven't had a barn burner of a close race in a statewide race, really since the John Kerry, George Bush presidential race of 2004, that typically in Wisconsin, people make up their minds toward the end and that margin gets bigger. And that's what happened yesterday. Walker was really organized down the stretch, I'll say that. He, after looking like he was sort of flailing and searching for a message kind of midsummer, did not have that appearance toward the end of the campaign. And, you know, he was an incumbent, and it was a midterm gubernatorial election, which both things bode well for Republicans in this election. And that just kind of came home there toward the end.
Who was responsible in terms of voting demographics for that 6-point win for Governor Walker last night?
In demographics, I can tell you I didn't have a chance to look over the exit polls in terms of age and gender, things like that. But looking at the map of Wisconsin and where the votes came, he won all over the place. I mean, he won counties that Democrats have to win if they're going to win a statewide election in Wisconsin. You know, for example, down in Kenosha County, he's done very well there. But for a Democrat to win, typically the pattern of success for Democrats is that they win counties like that. So Mary Burke did win a few more counties than Tom Barrett had in his two unsuccessful runs at Scott Walker. So she increased the Democratic map in that regard. On the other hand, we had record turnout in yesterday's gubernatorial race for a regular midterm gubernatorial race, but it was really Republican-driven. Mary Burke actually received about 23,000 fewer votes than Jim Doyle received for Democrats in 2006. So I think Democrats have to go back to the drawing board here and think about what happened in this race and, you know, what do they need to do for 2018.
And how did the vote pan out in the governor's race in terms of independents and men and women voters?
I haven't had a chance to look at the exit polling yet. I know that Scott Walker, toward the end there, looked like he was doing well with independent voters and men voters. You know, that was that gender gap existed throughout the polling on this race. There was, you know, and from what I could tell, from what little I did see of the exit polling, Walker won men as expected. Mary Burke won women. But independents went toward the governor, and that accounted in part for his margin of victory.
Now, moving on to the state Senate, where does it stand, and what does it say that, you know, it was a long shot that Democrats would have taken the Senate, had a majority there, but what is the message, a takeaway here about Wisconsin state politics?
Well, I think a couple of the races that Democrats targeted, as you mentioned, were not too great for them by the numbers, and the numbers turned out that way. They wanted to win the 19th state Senate district up in Outagamie and Winnebago counties. Thought they had a good candidate there in Representative Penny Bernard Shaver from Appleton, but she lost pretty handily to former Republican Representative Roger Roth. Democrats liked their candidate in Martha Lanning in the 9th Senate district in the eastern Wisconsin against Devin Lemahue. But that race wasn't close. I mean, it reflected the conservative nature of that district. And on a night when Governor Walker performed very well in those counties, other Republicans did too. In the 17th state Senate district in southwest Wisconsin, you know, if Democrats were ever going to have a chance, that would be a district where they should have done well, because Barack Obama won that seat with about 56% of the vote. But it was a fairly lopsided victory there, too. Howard Markline, the Republican, a conservative, with 55% of the vote over Pat Bomhack. You know, that's one race. That one in particular will probably be analyzed as to what went wrong, because you had an ugly Democratic primary there, and you had the Democratic minority leader of the Senate getting involved in that. That's not typical of the way races like that are run. I guess what Democrats will say is, look, there was a national wave election, and Wisconsin was not immune to that.
Now, one of the more closely watched races was for a seat in the U.S. House, and that was Tom Petri's former seat. What happened there?
Tom Petri's former seat, which is another one of those Republican seats, went to Republican Glenn Grothman, a different kind of a Republican for sure than Tom Petri. Glenn Grothman, regarded as one of the most conservative members of the state legislature, very outspoken and not a fan of Tom Petri, and I think it was mutual. Petri, not a fan of Glenn Grothman. He did not endorse Glenn Grothman, and Grothman was very prepared to run in a primary against Petri. So, you know, this is kind of a new type of Republican here in Glenn Grothman compared to Petri. He defeated Mark Harris in that district, 57% of the vote going to Glenn Grothman to 41% for Mark Harris, the Winnebago County executive. You know, that was not unexpected. We really don't have many competitive districts, congressional districts in Wisconsin. Every time they redraw the maps, it gets less and less competitive. And so they are there to protect incumbents, basically. And that's what happened last night.
Now, one of the big events on any election night is the victory speech or the concession speech. What did we see last night, both for Mary Burke and for Scott Walker?
I mean, you know, Mary Burke essentially told people, keep your head up. When, you know, you get knocked down, you have to get back up. Scott Walker's speech sounded very much like somebody who wants to be talked about as a candidate for president. He mentioned the word Washington 10 times in his speech, never in a flattering light. You know, he contrasted what we'd done here, in his words, to what they did in Washington. You know, he sounded like somebody who wanted to run for president. You know, normally in that stump speech that he gives, he'll attack Madison or say that, you know, the people in Madison want to keep more of your money, things like that. It was all about Washington last night. And even when he talked about the good things that they'd done in Wisconsin, his message often morphed to in Wisconsin and in America. In America, we believe. You know, I think a lot of people heard that speech last night and said, yeah, given the victory that he just had and given the way he's talking there, it's not going to be long before he's going to be out campaigning in Iowa.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us and catching us up.
All right, thank you.
We've been speaking with WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson about last night's elections here in Wisconsin.
Republicans swept almost all of the country's most closely contested races last night and ended the midterm elections with a new Senate majority, a bigger majority in the House, at least 31 successful governor races with a few yet to be called.
Republican success was widely predicted, but not to the degree seen last night. We discussed previously on Central Time the possibility that a Senate majority might not be decided until the weeks after the elections, but that's clearly not the case now. Republicans flipped at least 7 Senate seats, although they only needed to take 6 to become a majority.
Maybe it's too soon to say, but now officially begins the 2016 campaign. Paul Singer joins us every week to give us a behind-the-scenes look at Congress. He joins us now. Paul, I imagine you're a little short on sleep, but thanks for joining us.
No problem, Rob. Talking keeps me awake.
So how did last night's results compare with what we were expecting?
Well, it was a stronger performance, I think, across the board for Republicans than we were expecting. We expected these races to be close. In many cases, they were not close. Republicans outperformed the polls in state after state, even in places where Democrats won or appear to have won, like in Virginia, Senator Warner, Mark Warner. It was stunning how close that race was. For most of the night, challenger Ed Gillespie, who nobody expected to win, was leading in the tally. So it was a wave. It was a Republican wave. The thought was they might win a little, but they won a lot.
So what are people pointing to as key factors that basically shifted every prediction one column over in this race?
Yeah, well, exactly. Obama, I think, is the biggest. If you look at the way the races were run, by and large, Democrats were trying to run away from Obama and talk about state-based issues. Republicans were trying to talk about Obama and national issues, and that appears to have really trumped. The Republican voters were very mobilized, very motivated to get out and vote against Obama. The Democrats were not particularly mobilized and motivated to get out and vote for the people who will support Obama, and the independents all appear to be breaking towards the Republicans. I think the president was the biggest factor in this race.
And there was a lot of talk from the media and from Republicans saying, oh, Obama's hiding, they're not putting him out there on the campaign trail. I know the second guessing begins now. Has there been thinking from Democrats yet, like, well, we lost anyway, we might as well have had Obama front and center?
You know, what the interesting thing I've seen is from some of the progressive slash liberal groups who are saying that what we should have done, the Democrats should have done, is run a more unabashedly and unapologetically liberal campaign. They should have embraced economic populism of Elizabeth Warren. They should have embraced Obamacare. They should have embraced, some of the things that a lot of the centrist Democrats were unwilling to talk about on the campaign trail. So, sure, second-guessing shall go on. I mean, I think the problem is, you know, you're at a 40% approval rating for the president. That just hurts.
Now, this race isn't quite over. Louisiana still going on. You have to get over 50% to conclusively win. So they've got a runoff. What happens there now?
They'll have a runoff in December, first week of December. By all accounts, Mary Landrieu, the incumbent Democrat, had her best shot to win if she could get a lot of people to the polls yesterday and split, because at the moment there was 2 Republicans on the ballot, so she could split their vote and she might be able to win. She didn't get 50%. That means they go to a runoff with just the top two, that is her and Bill Cassidy, the Republican. By all accounts, Cassidy is far, far favored to win that race, and the Republicans will pick up another seat.
So big winners in the Republican Party now. Obviously, I guess Mitch McConnell has to be toward the top of that list. Not only did he win re-election by a bigger margin than people were predicting, he appears likely to be the Senate Majority Leader, one of his dreams throughout his career.
Yep, Yep, totally. I mean, Mitch McConnell just held a press conference where he looked like the cat who swallowed the canary. He was obviously very pleased, and he will be the Senate Majority Leader. And you know, he was very measured in his remarks, and he's not talking about, you know, ramming things down the president's throat just yet. He's talking about getting some stuff done, looking for places of agreement, and focusing particularly on reforming the procedures of the Senate to have more votes and have more open process, which is kind of interesting for those of us who are inside baseball kind of people.
Why is that interesting? Bring it outside.
Yeah, I mean, well, the whole deal is, and it is true, the way Congress now functions, particularly the Senate now functions, the majority leader, Harry Reid in this case, decides they want to have a bill. The only way to get the bill moving and to avoid a filibuster is to just basically block all amendments, block all votes except one. There's one filibuster vote and one, and assuming that passes, there's one yes or no vote. That's it. The committees don't matter much. The amendment process no longer really happens. The appropriations bills don't get approved in the committees. None of the normal order of Congress actually takes place. That is what Mitch McConnell says he wants to reform. However, I will tell you that the reason that happens is because as a majority leader, the Senate is really unwieldy if you let everybody talk.
So how are things going to work now? You said McConnell said there might be a few things we can pass that maybe President Obama will sign. What kind of issues can they agree on maybe quickly next year?
Well, the Republicans and Obama actually agree on opening up some new trade deals, international trade deals. The biggest hurdle to that has been Democrats. They don't like them by and large, particularly because the unions don't like them very much. And the environmentalists don't really like them. So that's one that I think Obama could easily sit down with the Republicans and work out a deal. You might also have some deals on minor revisions to corporate taxes. You might even actually have some reforms and revisions to Obamacare. Obama said he said in his press conference that he will not allow a repeal of the law. But he did not say he is closed to any revisions or reforms. And Mitch McConnell said basically the same thing. A total repeal will never pass. But that doesn't mean there's nothing we could do. Maybe they can find some stuff to work on.
One idea I've seen floated is that maybe with Republicans in control of both houses, gridlock could go down. There are fewer parties. It might be easier to get a unified message coming out of Congress and thus easier to negotiate between the White House and Congress. Does that seem plausible?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think what ends up happening is that instead of having a roadblock between the House and the Senate that prevents things from getting to the president, now you have the roadblock basically between the Congress and the White House. The roadblock becomes the president's desk. I think what that means is that more Republican ideas will pass because more of them will get to the president's desk, and there's only so many he can say no to. Sooner or later, he's going to have to say yes. So, yeah, some stuff will move. Now, of course, the issue will be whether the Republicans can keep their own flock in line. Today, Mitch McConnell said, we will not shut down the government. We will not threaten the credit of the United States by blocking a debt ceiling increase. Those views might be a little bit controversial in his own caucus.
Now let's turn to two words, 20 and 16. There's talk here after the Wisconsin elections about where Governor Walker might go, whether he might run. You had pointed in the USA Today in a video online that Republicans after this election were quickly pivoting to critique Hillary Clinton. Talk about that.
It was really funny. I mean, Rand Paul tweeted a series of Hillary losers pictures. That's pictures of Hillary Clinton standing with Democratic candidates who lost. The Republican Party put out a press release this morning talking about how this race was a rebuke of the Hillary Clinton agenda. Starting today, the Republican Party is focused less on Barack Obama and more on Hillary Clinton because they think she's the most likely to be the Democratic presidential candidate, and they're going to start tackling her now.
A big name on the Republican side who was going state to state was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. A lot of the candidates he backed won. Is there talk about him now in 2016?
Yeah, totally. I mean, a good night for Chris Christie. You know, if his job as the head of the Republican Governors Association was to protect and prop up endangered Republican governors like Scott Walker, like Rick Scott in Florida. And by the way, if you're going to run for president in 2016, not a bad thing to make friends and raise money in places like Wisconsin and Florida. So, I think Christie has clearly strengthened his hand for a possible 2016 run. He's a winner.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Paul, in 2008, big Democratic wins. People thought Republicans were out for a long time. They came back in 2010. There's talk of what's wrong with the Democrats. And so back and forth, back and forth. Is there anything about this election that makes you think Republicans are up, Democrats are down for a longer term this time?
No. But in fact, in 2016, the playing field favors Democrats significantly because a lot of the seats that are up are Republicans in Democratic states. So I think the House is more interesting and more sort of locked in. Wouldn't be surprised if Republicans have the majority there for a while. But then again, you know, a giant Democratic wave with a really successful presidential candidate might repeat the Obama successes of 2008. Everything turns on its head.
Well, I look forward to that conversation with you in 2 years, Paul, and to another one next week, looking in the shorter horizon.
But first, I'm going to go take a nap.
All right. Get some sleep. That was USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. We've been talking election results, but he joins us every week at this time to give an inside look at what's going on in Congress.